support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday, Tuesday, casual Tuesday, Wednesday, casual hump day, Thursday, casual Thurs, that's what we call it, and Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, January 8th, 2016. I'm Michael Brooks. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We're broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's Casual Friday, Cliff Schechter, political maestro and weekly guest of the Majority Report. Film guy, Matthew Weiss. Film pro, film guy. Regular guests in the Majority Report. We're going to be talking guns, militiamen, and this really exceptionally crazy and racist governor of Maine. I have a big soft spot for Maine. I went to college up there, and what's going on, guys? Matthew will give me a film recommendation. I meant the state of Maine, Kelly. Not you. Film guy Matthew will give me a film recommendation, which I will probably have time to watch, in contrast to Sam. And then, for the fun half, Sam Cedar returns. He comes back behind the mic. Will he still have his mustache? I don't know. Will he have stories about the jury duty process? Will he have complaints and kvetching? Most definitely. We will see him at around 12:55, 12:50, 1 o'clock, somewhere in that zone. But first, I'll take you through some conversations with Cliff and Matthew. Really quickly off the top, there's a new poll that came out today. That I don't have in front of me, but the point is that Jeb Bush is the only Republican candidate with a net negative amongst Republican voters, which is really bad because he is the second highest name ID after Donald Trump. So the Jeb Bush relaunch, the Jeb Bush reboot, the Jeb Bush rebrand is, well, it's looking like Jeb Bush is going to be able to go and do cooler things, as he would say. But Jeb is apparently desperate to not totally embarrass himself, and he's going back into his past, or maybe bringing out his inner Ben Carson to talk about his accomplishments. And last week where was this? Jeb Bush was speaking at the Conservative Leadership Project's Presidential Forum in Greenville, South Carolina. And he said that he received, quote, the NRA Statesman of the Year Award, and that Charlton Heston gave him a rifle. Let's play that sound.
In Florida, when I was governor, I was the NRA Statesman of the Year one year. It was on my highlight reel where Charlton Heston gave me a gun on the stage in front of 15,000 people. That was pretty cool, to be honest with you.
Yeah, it wasn't true. None of that is correct. The award apparently was not given to Jeb Bush and by the NRA. It was another award, and it was not presented by Charlton Heston. It was presented by a man in a deerskin cap.
A raccoon skin, actually.
Excuse me, a raccoon skin cap. And Jeb has not responded to this so far as I know, but I could see he could go off and like, I remember when Davy Crockett gave me a shotgun. That was pretty That was awesome.
There was one time John Wayne gave me the VFW award for most energetic candidate.
I remember when Daniel Boone gave me the here's a gun and your brother and Jeb Bush and everybody else can suck it award. I'm really not enjoying this process in any way, shape, or form.
Outlaw Josie Wales gave me the... he presented me with the golden crossbow for the most fiscally conservative governor.
I love it. Oh, man. But you know what? To quote Jeb's own words when he spoke about the Tamir Rice verdict, he said the system is working, or the system worked. I disagree with him about the death of an innocent 13-year-old child. But I sort of agree with him when it comes to him and the political process. In some sense, the process is working because it's making a complete mockery of him and his delusional and corporate-saturated trust fund baby legacy campaign. And watching it go down in flames is very entertaining. Okay, we will be right back after a brief break with Cliff Schechter. Welcome back. Casual Friday and the Majority Report. Matt's music choice. So save your tweets for him. Joining us now is Cliff Schechter, my good friend Cliff. Obviously, before we talk to Cliff, in any scenario, we have to play the Cliff Schechter theme song. So, Matt, let's hear it.
Cliff Schechter, Libertas LLC. New media, public relations, and strategy. You want any of these services, you know who you gotta see. Cliff Schechter, Libertas LLC.com.
Cliff, how you doing, Paizan? What's going on?
Doing all right. It's been quite a week, my friend.
Yeah,
quite
it really week. Has. It really has. And it's been a week that, you know, obviously reflects a lot of things, but you know, this is an issue. We're talking about guns, of course, that you, I would say, not only, I mean, you work on, but you really sort of pour your heart and soul into. And I think that there has been something of a shift. I mean, there obviously has been something of a shift, and a shift that I might add you've been predicting for a while, my friend, even when other people are a lot more pessimistic. And that's important to note as well. But let's get to it. Before we go into, you have a good piece in the Daily Beast talking about the politics around it. But before we do that, can you give a just sort of concise explanation, first, of what President Obama's executive order actually does? And then we'll touch briefly on President Obama's op-ed in the New York Times that came out yesterday, which also has some really important political ramifications as well.
Sure. Let me begin by thanking you guys for having me on. And as for your kind comment about my predicting this, you know, obviously I see things on the inside and from, you know, and I'd been saying that while it's still depressing and it will always be as these shootings continue to occur, you know, you can see what is changing, especially when you're kind of working on the inside of this and you're watching it from that vantage point of how culturally we're changing. It's just that's obviously longer-term change because the NRA had the field to themselves during the first decade of this, of our new century here, and that we're still living with that for most of it anyhow. But to get to what President Obama did, So, look, as I think most people are aware, right after the tragedy in Newtown, you had Senators Manchin and Toomey, both A-rated by the NRA, both gun owners, get together and put together what was very reasonable legislation dealing with background checks, something, by the way, that the NRA fully and vocally supported in 1999 after Columbine,
right.
And something that many senators, it was actually passed in the Senate, a similar version to close the gun show, you know, loopholes, it was known then. There weren't as many internet sales then, so it really was mostly a loophole of gun shows and things of that sort. And you know, you had a number, I mean, Mitch McConnell, for example, voted for that.
Right.
I mean, a number of Republicans who suddenly now are born again, you know, all gun background checks will lead to tyranny. You know, we're not that way. But so what President Obama did is what was left for him to do, because they blocked it, even though we had 55 votes. And they, that was not going to be good enough because they filibuster everything. So what he did here is he did what is in his purview as President of the United States to do, which is to define certain rules and regulations and what they mean, define what the language means. And so in this, the bill that was passed, the Brady bill in 94 or so, 94, 95, was, you know, talked about the fact that people who are not in the business, put that little term in quotes, of selling guns, would not have to conduct background checks. And back then, you didn't, you know, people always find ways to create loopholes. What you had essentially was, you know, a few people here and there, they wanted to sell an antique gun, or they wanted, you know, they had a couple extra guns lying around from the family that were left to them in a will, and they wanted to sell those. And it was, you know, those folks should not have to do the kind of background check, and background checks were not as easily conducted back then, that we didn't have the technology we have now. And so that was what was needed to get it through, especially to get some of the rural state you know, congressional leader or members, leaders, others to vote in favor of it. But what we saw happen, and, you know, we've got this on video, for example, some of the stings I worked on, what was then Mayors Against Illegal Guns with, and now Everytown is the obviously the newer iteration of the organization. You'd find somebody at a gun show, actually one of them was here in Ohio, we did Tennessee, we do these undercover stings, and you'd see these guys saying, yeah, I don't need to do a background check, I've sold 150 assault weapons this year. So essentially they took advantage of this loophole, and they would claim, well, I'm not really in the business of selling guns. And what President Obama did is he clarified that, which is that if you derive, you know, the majority of your income from selling guns, if you sell multiple guns, you know, no one thing will determine, but common sense will determine. If you're selling tons of guns, if you're deriving a lot of your income from it, you know, and these kinds of things, you are in the
business
of
selling
guns.
An antique heirloom. I mean, that's sort of as basic as it gets, and you can't exploit that loophole anymore if you're in the gun business. That's really the sort
of bottom
line.
Some of these people still will exploit. There's no
sure.
Because you can't change it to the level it needs to be changed, which is to pass a universal, what Washington State did via ballot initiative, what Oregon did in their legislature, more recently Delaware did in their legislature, and a number other states had done this in the past. And we'll have two more ballot measures, at least two, coming up this year in Maine, which we're going to talk about that state in a little bit, I believe.
Yeah, we sure are.
And Nevada, that we'll do that too. So this will not do that, because there will be some people that still can say, you know, I sell 10, maybe I sell 6 guns a year on the side. That's not my main business, not whatever. And they may be able to get away with that and not be in the business. And so we have to be clear with people. It does not close all these loopholes, especially online also. But it's a much better thing. And the thing is about, as we've discussed ad nauseum on this show and every other place I've talked about this, is that when you realize that what guns are, and which is a public health problem, as smoking has been, as, you know, eating fatty foods, as, you know, drunk driving, these are not things that you ever defeat by just doing one thing. You get at them from all sides. You need education. You need cultural change. You know, at the turn of the last century, there were spittoons at every bar because everybody chewed tobacco and was just sitting there spitting constantly. Now that doesn't exist, right? I mean, culture changed. It does.
Right. You're talking about a really interdependent kind of multivariable process. And obviously, I mean, what Obama did is right from the kind of Maoist Iranian handbook. But yeah, no.
Oh, well, he's a Maoist.
Yeah, we know.
Well, and
no, he's
down.
Actually more of an Ayatollah
yes.
Maoist. I mean, you got to be really clear.
His middle name is Hussein. You need to remember that.
Yeah, and right.
Look, I mean, just beyond the joking about it, so people know, the background check part was not the only one. There's also been other ways that he also closed another loophole where some of these people have bought guns even machine guns, which are one of the examples that always proves the NRA and all of their acolytes wrong, because we regulated the hell out of those during the 1920s and 30s. It's actually the 1930s, the Miller Act. We did that because that was our last experiment in prohibition gone wrong. And what we in with that regulation, very few people are able to get a hold of. You don't see people, you know, showing up at and killing people with machine guns. It almost never happens.
Tommy guns equal freedom.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But they're able to get them through trusts, some people are, and through sort of corporate loopholes if they don't get them directly. And so this closes that. This also provides some money for mental health, which the Republicans say they're in favor of doing.
Right.
Of course, I'm assuming that's just a talking point and they'll never support the actual funding. And also pushes funding for smart gun technology, which should just be common sense. You know, as President Obama said when he spoke about this, we don't allow kids to go to – we realized the kids were getting their hands on Tylenol and dying, you know, or that kind of thing. So we created bottles that kids can't open.
So these
we
are when
the
you say smart
for a long
guns.
Time
are...
to create guns they can't shoot.
Right.
And yet we haven't done it.
Right. And also make them easier to track in their purchases with serial numbers.
That's
and
right.
things like that. So let's just briefly – okay. So, I mean, essentially on a policy level, you're talking about incredibly – commonsensical things that are within the president's authority because he's strengthening pre-existing laws and he's also doing things where the government can sort of directly intervene in terms of its own actual role in the domestic arms market, which is essentially what guns are, let's be real. But it does seem like with Obama coming out like this, it also signifies a little bit of the cultural shift, actually, that you were talking about.
Actually, that is very astute, Michael, as you always are, because I think that is as important, if not more important here, because he can't make any big moves on his own. Will this save some lives? Absolutely. The gun show, the loophole part of it, there's no doubt. I would predict it now will save numerous lives, but not nearly enough, because we're talking about thousands upon thousands, and you know we're at an epidemic level here. But culturally, when the you know with Hillary Clinton and Martin O'Malley talking about this a lot, which has led Bernie Sanders to improve his position a lot, it's led a lot of other Democrats who in the past were not good on this issue to improve their positions on it, which means you've got at least people speaking out publicly. You've seen People magazine do an issue on this because they, you know, you've seen, you know, sports stars wear orange like the New York Mets did. You've seen some NBA stars cut an ad. These are all cultural changes. You know, when you see people in the news who are in the news, whether they're politicians, whether they're athletes, actors, musicians, when they start speaking out on these things, it makes an incredibly huge impact. And so, you know, we see it a lot now. I see it in all sorts of places, the ones I just mentioned and others, that you never saw this issue discussed before.
Yes.
And so what President Obama did in commanding so much attention and being so clear and, frankly, having a very human moment, I'm sure he was just faking those tears, though, cut those onions below the, as they say on Fox, because they're such class.
Well, see, in Shia law, what you do is you can sort of fake tears to, it's called deceive the infidel. I can't help myself.
If you follow Sharia, it's very cool how that just allows you to gain control of your tears in that manner.
Imagine me crying about white kids, please.
That's right.
You didn't notice anything else
he's ever cried about, did you? I mean, you don't cry about anything. I mean, he's just thinking about black kids because that's the black president.
Right, and also black kids that, you know, let's also be clear, I don't know, I mean, I know his Muslim affiliations, but I don't know what gang he rolls with, so maybe not all black kids.
And all those black kids clearly deserved it, right? They had it coming.
Oh, naturally, I mean, because they're black. Looking for something else to put around it? They're black.
There's no other solution here. They're black.
Obviously, I mean, I hate to say this, but we don't have time to be PC anymore. So before we loop this conversation, I want to actually underline those two points, actually, that you just raised about the cultural shift. And President Obama spoke to them in his Times op-ed. He said
that's
in the corner, the big political takeaway is I'm not campaigning for Democrats that aren't solid on this issue. That's a big political takeaway. The cultural takeaway, and I think it was very interesting because this is definitely, it's a shift. I mean, it's a shift on a number of levels.
I just want to quote this really quickly, Cliff,
and then you can jump in. Yep. He says at the end of the op-ed, this is President Obama, quote, change will be hard. It won't happen overnight. But securing women's rights didn't happen overnight. The liberation of African Americans didn't happen overnight. Advancing the rights of lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender Americans has taken decades of work. He's directly lining up this issue with the sort of mass liberatory struggles of America. And that is a fundamental reframe. Yeah.
Yes, the framing of that is incredibly smart and frankly quite true, because of who is preyed upon when you see states without without background checks. There's 18 states without background checks, and you see states without them. Women are more likely to be killed by a partner of theirs,
right.
46% more likely to be killed with a gun by a partner of theirs. When you see the disproportionate effect on African American communities, Hispanic communities, whatever, that the reason why we haven't done what you would expect with guns is the same reason we didn't act quickly on AIDS, and we didn't act, it's because who's being killed are frankly the people that haven't been in control of our society.
Right.
And so it is a civil rights issue. And so to have him line up like that was hugely important. And I think culturally also as important in that op-ed to say the kind of thing that some of us have been saying now who find this issue to be as important as any other issue out there as an epidemic, which is, he said, I won't campaign for, I won't support even members of my own party who will not stand up for common sense gun. And that affects people. That gets people to change positions. And that's hugely important too. So good for him. What he's put into this issue has been amazing. What he's done more recently. What I was going to say quickly is it capped also like a 2 to 3 week period of time that I think a lot of people who don't follow this closely may not know. But a number of hugely important things happened on the cultural front. You had the Attorney General of Virginia cancel all reciprocity, well, not all, 25 of 30 reciprocity agreements when it comes to concealed carry, which means if you get a concealed carry permit in Virginia and you get one, let's say, in Alaska, you can move to the other state and it'll be just as good in the other state. Well, Herring, who won running very openly on gun safety, looked at these other states, and 25 of the 30 of them, the standards to get a concealed carry permit were so much lower than they were in Virginia that he felt that it creates a danger for Virginians, which it does. States, where you can get one when you're blind, or if you're known to be an alcoholic, or if you've committed, misdemeanor acts of violence, and you can still get
freedom,
among many other things. And so that
freedom.
Was one huge
freedom.
Yeah, exactly. That was one huge thing. A second huge thing was in Seattle, what the NRA has done is in states where they've controlled legislatures at times, and sadly this is about now somewhere about 2/3 of the states, they pass these preemption laws, because we all know conservatives believe in localism, small government, state government, local government, until it's stuff they don't believe in, like gays getting married and other things of that nature. And guns are another one. So they did this to stop stronger laws being passed in places like Cleveland and Seattle. They passed these preemption laws in the state legislature. Well, the city of Seattle did is they said, fine, what we are going to do is we're going to impose a tax on ammunition and on firearms. And they went to the court system, and the courts upheld it, saying this is nothing to do with the Second Amendment. This is their right of taxation. That could have huge implications for cities who are trying to deal with this problem around the country, and that was a big win. So you've had a couple of these other kinds of high profile wins. Oh, and also Cook County in Chicago, because they don't have this idiotic preemption, because Illinois has been mostly controlled by Democrats, passed an assault weapons ban, and that was upheld too. So if you're watching this as closely as I do, that what the president did was sort of the culmination of like 2 or 3 weeks of huge momentum on this issue, and that's incredibly important culturally and in terms of our courts and our laws. So
absolutely. So good. So Cliff, that is really good, and I know we're running a little tight on time, and I know we wanted to talk about the clowns in Oregon, which we have talked about a lot in the show, and I'll give you. You can sort of say whatever joke you had preloaded on Oregon, because it's such a disaster. But I really, before you go,
Vanilla ISIS, Al-Qaeda, Yokel Harem.
I call them pale Qaeda. That's mine. That's my original contribution.
I'm going with a Yokel Harem. I like that a lot.
Yokel.
Everybody has their own.
If everybody could bring us some granola bars and some Slim Jims, we can really take this country back.
Well, did you see this thing about the guy who escaped with all of the money they had raised? he ran away and ditched his fellow brothers in arms with the money.
See, I respect that guy. To me, that's American entrepreneurship.
Like, these guys are just, I mean, they're laughable. They're not, I mean, it's really, you know what? We can make a lot of jokes. We don't need to talk about it for very long.
Yes, because I want to get to LePage.
What's going on here. I'll just say, what it does is it brings into focus the very radical 10 to, you know, 15%, usually around 10, that oppose background checks, who tend to be, you know, there's a few of them that are the gun company guys who are making money and they don't care. But the vast majority of who they're exploiting, these gun guys who are making money off this, are the most radical, socially, you know, awkward, mentally unhinged, the ones that think that, you know, they the tinfoil hat wearers, the ones that think that, you know, that the government is implanted something in their ear. And I mean, I go on and on, but you know who I'm talking about. And this is them. And they're not serious people. They're clowns. They're the 10% that right now that Cruz and Trump are pandering to in the Republican primary.
And just to be clear, Cliff, 10%
is probably like 60% of the Republican primary voters.
And just to be clear, Cliff, I think we should not, I mean, I think you and I both know from sort of the information that we're privy to, I wouldn't be so cavalier about talking about the computer chips in people's ears program. But that's just an addendum. Yeah,
because
we got to be right here.
It's all what you prefer.
Okay, so speaking of all of this, you know, the governor of Maine, and I say this, like, I went to Bates up in Maine. I have a big soft spot for that state, and it's not...
I lived there for a little bit, too, in Portland, so I feel the same
way. Maine is not a crazy state. It's a state that's had a lot of hard times, and it struggles economically. But Paul LePage, who won re-election a couple years ago as a result of a so-called, you know, an independent... sort of nonsense, kind of third way.
In a socially liberal independent run and basically screwed the Democrats.
Basically screwed the Democrats. Yes, not once but twice, which is why this demented far right hang out with sovereign citizens groups lunatics is the governor. And he said at a town hall meeting on Wednesday, I just want to distill this because look.
He's won, just to be clear with people, he's won with something like 34, 33% of the vote now twice.
Right. Right, like, that's how he slides through.
I may be saying a little lower than, I'm not sure, but it's not,
It's not above the mid-30s. So he said, you know, because Maine, along with the rest of rural New England, is actually suffering from a heroin epidemic right now. And his, of course, brilliant solution to this, I'm sure, obviously, nothing about decriminalization, nothing about treatment programs, obviously, you know, God forbid. He says, well, you know, the problem is basically that you have these out-of-state traffickers coming from places like Connecticut and New York with, quote, names like D-Money, Smoothie, Shifty. These are all real 80s names.
Shifty is a good
they
name.
Sound like supporting characters in King of New York, which is one of my favorite movies, if LePage have seen that.
Also, we're forgetting. Yeah. Wasn't the guy's name G? No, it wasn't D-Money. It was G-Money.
G-Money.
With Wesley Snipes. What was the name of that?
No, that's New Jack City. King of New York's with Christopher Walken.
No, that one was awesome too.
Yeah. Oh, they're both awesome. Movies. Yeah. No doubt. I'm M Money, but I don't go up to Maine, right?
Yeah.
So, and they quote, they come up here, they sell their heroin, and they go back home. And half the time, they impregnate young white girls before they leave, which is a real sad thing, because we have another issue that we got to deal with down the road.
You know, young white girls just wandering around as they do, and boom. Yeah. They're pregnant because there's heroin dealers there.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
I mean, I don't really have any... I mean, this is like Donald Trump. There's no subtext. But I don't... And I, you know, and we have a guy who, you know, is actually a loyal listener to the show we like, who calls in and everything. And I, you know, I don't think he's like, you know, personally a racist or anything like that. But the reality is like, how can you not look at this party and look at the structure and look at the friggin' governor of Maine, something like that, and still, you know what? From a mainstream press perspective, I think this is the big point. How long with these people saying this stuff without any subtext? They've been saying it for years, frankly, but with more obfuscation.
Them as real people?
Treating them as real people and talking about the extreme right and the extreme left. Like, well, you have Bernie Sanders out there on the extreme left saying that, you know, kids shouldn't be cold. And we should have a rational healthcare system.
Saying humanitarian things that like 70% of the population actually 70, support.
Exactly. And then, you know, on the other side, you have guys talking about D Money and J Smooth and Shifty getting our precious white girls pregnant. Yeah, these are not equivalent things. And this is what the Republican Party
problem is. I mean, look, did you see the Obama's talk on guns last night? Like, I've tried to get more and more sort of sanguine, you know, I've tried to really...
I still got to teach you how to meditate, Cliff, I know.
Well, of course. Well, no, I do some yoga and I work out.
Oh, look at you!
But I'm trying to get more, feel more positive that mainstream media is changing. Because, for example, with the gun issue, right? You saw some people that usually that often have been conservative and often are blowhards. I think of Scarborough. I think of David Frum, who, you know, have been so reasonable on this and frankly have excoriated their own on it. So you think, well, maybe some people in the media are changing. Maybe they won't give equal side to the other side that's full of it. But then you watch something like last night where Anderson Cooper, I don't know if you saw that when he was trending on
Twitter.
Oh, my
God, it was absolutely ludicrous.
Basically, one
just
of these
explain
people
it.
Says,
yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, one of these people said one of these crazy things about Obama coming and taking away their guns, and, you know, he's like, and Anderson Cooper's whole sort of thing is this, well, if they believe it, doesn't that make it real?
Well, let me actually jump in. It was even
isn't
worse.
Isn't that a legitimate conspiracy theory? It's like, no, because a bunch of crazy people that listen to Rush Limbaugh, watch Fox News, receive emails from the Koch brothers and the NRA, believe it doesn't make it legitimate. I can believe that gravity doesn't exist. I maybe can convince 60% of the people out there of that if I'm lucky, but that doesn't mean it's true.
Right? Gravity is a really PC concept, and I'm sorry. Yeah, I'm not really
into
that.
Point, which is, yeah. So that's my sadness, is when I see Anderson Cooper, who's a reasonable guy, and usually I consider to be one of the better of the reporters out there, when I see him sit there and act so idiotic about this and try in bending over so far to try to make there be equality between the two sides, when one side is making crap up with no evidence and the other side has statistics to show you that background checks work, it's, you know, and that has never called for taking everybody's guns, it's like, no, I mean, you're right. I mean, at what point do the LePages of the world do we just say, this is not a legitimate person? Donald Trump is not a legitimate person. Ted Cruz is not a – I don't like Marco Rubio. I don't like Jeb Bush. But I think they're legitimate people. I think they have records
they
can run it.
Yeah,
I don't know. Their records, I think, suck. I think it's quite clear that they're terrible at what they've done. But, I mean, they're not just – I mean, to their credit, they're not completely – and there's no doubt each of them has slipped into it here and there. Their whole candidacies are not just based on lies and conspiracy theories, right? And you need to be able to know the difference. And these guys don't seem to be willing to do that. And LePage is an example. I mean, I feel so sorry for my friends from Maine. I mean, you know this from being up there. Like, Maine is a lot, has a part of the state. I was in Portland, you know, that so much reminds you of Massachusetts or Rhode Island, this great sort of Yankee sort of tradition of supporting reform and progress and whatever, but then you've got the northern part of the state where, as you pointed out, is much more of an area that's industrial, and jobs have been lost just like Midwestern states would have been hit so hard by jobs going to China, and so it's created a market for the ideas of people like LePage.
Yeah, it's created a market for some you know, pop-up ad on WorldNet Daily to become governor of the state, and it's horrible.
Right, and not for 50.1% of people in that state, but because this idiot who ran as a third-party guy and siphoned off votes, it's created a market for a good third of the state to believe in this kind of crap.
It's Elliot Cutler, I think his name is, and he should never, ever, ever live it down. Cliff, we got to run.
No, I mean, and this guy is so not Maine. At least the part of Maine I lived in, I actually traveled all over the state, but when I lived in Portland and it's such a sort of, you know, respectful, cautious, classy kind of place. And yet this guy is out of like a novel about a Southern preacher. And it's just, you know,
with
I
less
feel bad
charm,
for him. I can't
with
even
less
imagine
charm.
It. Yeah.
With a lot less
so
charm.
He, I mean, look, what do you say? He's a racist. We knew that. He said many terrible things about people before. He's a sexist. He says some of the worst things.
He's literally crazy. He's absolutely conspiratorial. And I got to say, you know, I don't even entirely agree with you on the Rubio, Bush thing. I think that there's obviously degrees to this, but they're on the same continuum. And you'll see, I mean, especially when it comes to when they talk about
policies are crap. I agree with you.
But even when Marco Rubio talks about a clash of civilizations and stuff like that, it's demented. It's not real.
And that stuff should be consistently, constantly pointed out. I just mean, maybe I've probably missed some things. I haven't heard them get into the Agenda 21 crap as Ted Cruz did to win in Texas. I haven't heard them, you know, do that kind of stuff.
Well, they're running on the old model where you have surrogates and people who endorse you say that to send your signals versus just saying yourself.
And you should take apart, and the big thing that the media needs to do, which you're exactly correct about, is even if they're not completely running on conspiracy theories and stupid slogans and things that make no sense, their policies don't work. They're a joke. I mean, Rubio, let's take Rubio. His tax policy, his tax cut would be like 2 to 3 times the size of George W. Bush's, which bankrupted us and screwed our economy, among other things, right? I mean, his economic policy is not serious. It's a joke. On abortion rights, he was the one of the 2 or 3 of them that got up. I think Huckabee got up during that debate and said, not only are there no exceptions in cases of rape and incest, there's no exceptions in the case of the life of the mother. Well, that's not workable either, because the conclusion then becomes, which women and which doctors are you throwing in prison?
No, and that's all. And all every question. Single part of that statement is just as insane as anything that comes out of
Ted
Cruz's mouth.
Right, so they're insane policies that don't work and have been proven not to work. I agree with you 1,000,000%. Those need to be pointed out. I'm just saying, I've just meant, yes, there's a slight difference between them and the guys that are running completely on conspiracy theory. They're running on policies that are stupid, right-wing, and don't work. And that should be pointed out, too.
All right.
These guys refuse to do that. They refuse to say, you know, we've tried supply-side economics. In fact, we've had some pretty good petri dishes in Wisconsin and Kansas, and they've devastated these states, you know, not to mention the United States after Reagan. So it doesn't, you know, I wish they could do that and say, this isn't, you know, it's not about, like, I have to be objective in terms of, I have to say part A, you know, a little bit from A, a little bit from B. It's that you're supposed to give people objective truth. That's what you're supposed to do as a newscaster. And if that means one person is making crap up and is wrong, well, then you need to say that, you know. And that's the problem, is that they don't understand what objectivity at this point means. It means we need objective truth from them. We need things supported by scientific data, historical accuracy, and the rest. And they won't do it. Because everybody has to have a chance to be right.
That's exactly right.
I wish I could tell you that's going to change, but I often think it is because of some small changes, like I said, but the Anderson Cooper didn't make me feel so good about that last night.
I agree with you, Cliff, and it's so bizarre how the right-wing parties, the postmodern, the kind of clownish version of postmodern party with all that
stuff.
Isn't
it funny? The right-wingers, the conservatives, are the ones who always hated postmodernism.
And they're the ones what's reality, man? Hey, I really appreciate your time, Cliff. It is a pleasure, as always.
My pleasure, too. Thanks for having me on to talk about this stuff, my man.
Awesome, man. Talk to you soon.
Take care, buddy.
Take care. I think we're going to get to Film Guy Matthew in a second. Do we have a Jimmy Reefer Cake song? All right, why don't we throw that on? What is the name of it?
This is My Land.
Okay, let's listen. Hopefully it involves Paul Lepage.
It's This Land Is My Land.
This Land Is My Land. Okay.
As I went walking that ribbon of highway, that's when I found me a bird sanctuary, a wildlife refuge made perfect for me. I'm the kin of the great Cliven Bundy. This land is my land, this land is my land, 'cause in Nevada I born the legend of Cliven. 'Cause Bundy stood strong and the feds faltered. This land was made for me and me. Always carrying an AK-47. If the feds kill me, I'll go to heaven. But I can beat them like Father Bundy. Singing, this land was made for me and me. This land is my land, this land is my land, 'cause in Nevada I born the legend of Cliven. 'Cause Bundy stood strong and the feds faltered. This land was made for me and me.
Thank you.
back to the Majority Report. I'm Michael Brooks. Little logistical hiccup there, but that was actually a great Jimmy Reefer Cake song. So let's just give him, is my 360 up? All right. So we can't give you full applause, but kudos. Joining us now for a film pick is the singular, the one and only, the Jewish LeBron James of film, film guy, Matthew Weiss. Let's play his theme song. How are you, Matthew?
Hello, Michael. I am well. Great to see you, and thank you for that extremely high praise, LeBron James, Jewish LeBron James.
You like the Jewish LeBron James?
Absolutely. It's a lot to live up to. But, yeah, it reminds me that the last time I saw you was when I forced you to light the Hanukkah candles with me and Mary the
yes.
other night when we were working together.
Yes, and it was tough for me because of my secret Muslim identity. It was sort of physically painful. It was kind of like an Obama moment for me. That I was just like, I have to light the infidels' candles, but it's for the greater mission.
You were a good sport. I made you put on the yarmulke and everything, and you even took it well when I suggested that you should blow out the candles, and you actually almost did, but I stopped you, thankfully, in time.
Yeah, because that would have actually led to the dissolution of the State of Israel.
It would have.
So I'm glad that you were able to catch that.
Direction.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I actually, we watched, maybe more to the point, we watched the playoffs together, a couple games of the playoffs.
Yeah, that's right.
We were
with
watching
the real LeBron James.
With the real, with the regular
LeBron James.
With LeBron James Light, as I call him.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, as compared to you. So
I see. Thank you. Wow. Yeah. This is getting crazy now.
I was shocked at how emotionally invested you were in that, to be honest with you.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, the one real thing that I remember from my attachment to professional sports is living in northeastern Ohio as a youth and realizing that they always got beat, whether it was in football by John Elway, and mostly what I was interested in is in basketball by Michael Jordan. So the fact that an Akron-born kid who sort of is like the new Michael Jordan is now actually playing for that team, It's highly satisfying on all sports levels.
Okay. But you got I rooted for them out of empathy for you. But there was some I liked what Golden State
was.
I like Golden
State. Yeah. I think what you might have been most shocked by is my telling you to like stop talking while I'm watching the game.
That was incredible. Especially because you were talking.
Well,
the whole time. I was like, excuse me.
I get into this with Mary. There's like a skill into like how to talk during something that you're actually also paying attention to. You kind of have to be like surgical, get in and get out. Mostly when I'm watching a movie or like a TV show I'm really into, it's like a hermetically sealed environment. I just want to be one-on-one, absorbed by the work of art in front of me. But there's occasionally the kind of show that or movie that you can kind of riff on. But even then, it's like, I don't want to miss anything.
You remind me of like Schopenhauer. That's almost like from like World as Will and Representation there.
Really? I never really read any Schopenhauer. So, maybe the guy's got something there.
Maybe the guy's got something there. Why are, really briefly, before you get, and I hope that you have a pick that's specific to me.
Totally.
Which I actually will watch. Why are sports movies generally so bad? Because it actually could
exactly
be great.
Why I feel they're so bad. It's because
other than Cool Runnings, obviously.
Of course, than Cool Runnings and possibly Necessary Roughness. But I'll tell you why. Because sports, to me, for all of its fakery, for all of its emotional manipulation, for all of its jingoistic sort of qualities and the kind of groupthink tribalism, the one thing that it has over any other thing is you don't know how it's going to turn out. it still could actually go wrong. And you're engaged on that level, that it's real, that it you know, something is going to happen that maybe you don't expect.
Like, even if it's fixed, we don't know it.
Right, exactly. Right. You don't know it.
Right.
But in a movie, it's sort of, like, predictable. And, yeah, there's the even the twist of, like, oh, they don't win the big game is still kind of predictable because it can only really be in service of, you know, the ending of the story. So, to me, the sports movies, although there are some good ones that don't necessarily hinge on will they or won't they win the big game, for instance, like Rocky is a great example. Right. But to me, that's why they sort of fall flat, because they attempt to give us what is interesting in sports without the main thing, which is the most interesting, which is their actual spontaneity.
Right. What about, do you think Hoop Dreams holds up as a documentary?
Oh, yeah. You know, I haven't seen it since its original release, but that was clearly about a guy who was not going to make it. You know, it was sort of like the deck was stacked against him, and it didn't really give you this feeling of, like, he could really make it. And I remember learning later what happened to him and just sort of how he never really made it in the pros. But even the guy that in the documentary was like the better of the two. But that works on a level of character study, on sociology, on, you know, emotional connections to his community. It doesn't hinge on, you know, what's going to happen as much.
So, okay, so you can't make one that has to do with some type of culminating event. Because even like the Nelson Mandela movie that they made about rugby, which was, you know, it was like a kind of expected Clint Eastwood movie. It wasn't bad. But it was very, you know, it was Invictus. But it was almost like the symmetry of the, like, you knew how the game was going to end and you knew how where South Africa was going to go. And then what was funny was, you know, of course, it didn't exactly go that way. And the other thing actually that really frustrated me about that movie was that I think probably Nelson Mandela was right. It was a very smart calculation to embrace the rugby team. But the funny thing was that he, like, the way the movie depicts members of the African National Congress that want to change the name of the rugby team and not have it be this, like, apartheid era, at least kind of, like, overtly change the symbols, they're depicted as, like, lunatics. It's like, well, you know, Nelson Mandela had sort of unusual foresight, but, like, it's not like these guys, like, they have them, like, coming out, like, looking like extras.
Aren't
and Dave Chappelle.
Aren't rugby players lunatics? Isn't that, like, part of what they have to be?
Not if they're played by Matt Damon. They're pretty solid.
You know, and you remind me of why I'm not necessarily all that turned on by historical biopics for the most part. Same thing. You sort of, if you're familiar with the real history, then that's a very interesting story. But to see it in a film, I'm always going like, well, what part of this was sort of shaved or sculpted to make it more a compelling, slimmer narrative? You know, so it's the rare, based on true story, you know, grand scheme of things, historical narrative that I find interesting.
What's
Although
one of those
Lawrence
that works?
Lawrence of Arabia is a notable exception.
Oh, that's what it is? Lawrence of Arabia?
Well, that's just one that comes to mind. Is like, I love that movie, even though it's, you know, obviously a historical epic.
Got you.
With some, you know, editorialization.
So, speaking of historical epics with editorialization, that sounds like stuff that maybe I would like. What recommendation do you have for me, Matthew, which I will actually watch?
Well, here's the thing. I have a couple titles that I want to drop on you today.
Okay.
As my duties as Matthew Film Guy, I wanted to point out that the TV show Deadwood is getting a feature film wrap-up, which for all the people who didn't know that, there was it was dropped off after the third season, and that's a historical
epic. And that was an HBO show.
It was an HBO show, and I just heard today that is getting a feature film wrap-up. So if you haven't seen the show, I suggest you binge-watch that in preparation for that movie coming out. That was one of my favorite HBO shows post-Sopranos era. And then the other thing that I want to tell you, and all residents of New York City or the Tri-State area, is that one of my favorite filmmakers from the 60s, a woman named Shirley Clarke, whose film Portrait of Jason, I believe I have recommended before, they're doing an entire retrospective of her at the Museum of Arts and Design, which is in Columbus Circle. Mm-hmm. And they're showing all of her films. But most interesting to me is they're showing her film The Cool World, which has never really been released. You can only get it on a really crappy, like, VHS bootleg online somewhere, and not even legally. and they're showing it in 16mm projected.
Can you get it barely legally, Matt? I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Barely legally? Yeah. I'm not going to touch that one. But the cool world is something that I believe will appeal to you, Michael.
Yes.
It's sort of a look at the gang violence and the youth in Harlem in the 50s and 60s.
So it's a documentary.
No, it's actually it's got documentary elements to it, cast with sort of real people in a sort of a hybrid, but it's still a fiction film. It's narrative fiction, but it closely mirrored the reality of the time in Harlem. And it's also being preceded by her short film, which I show in my graduate editing class a lot, called Bridges Go Round, which is a short sort of a non-narrative film. So I highly recommend attending that screening next Friday at 7 p.m. at the Museum of Arts and Design to see this film. Which
maybe you and I will go together.
That'd be great.
Maybe we'll have
That'd
a little date.
Let's hold hands. Let's we can have popcorn.
Let's not. I won't invite anybody else, and you don't invite Mary. It'd be just you and me.
That's fine. You know, Mary may not be able to go anyway, so this will work out great.
Oh, that's actually a bummer. I always like to see Mary. Okay, so,
but,
so those
this
are...
This way you can scan the crowd, look for, you know.
I get the joke that you're making. Let's not touch that one either.
Let's keep going.
Yeah, let's power forward here. We've only got another minute or two.
LeBron James is a power forward.
Yes, he is, like you. You're the power forward of film recommendation.
That's right. Okay, yeah. So powering forward, the thing that I want to release to the world in order to as a recommendation is, okay, so you and everyone in the office there, you're all Brooklynites, isn't that correct?
Yeah, actually we are. Yeah.
All four, even when Sam's there, are Brooklynites.
All
are
four.
Are you aware of, right?
Yeah.
Are you aware of Brick TV, the Brooklyn Public Access Network?
Yes. Yes, I am.
So they have recently commissioned a TV series by a filmmaker who I love and who I've worked with. It's a good friend of mine named Kaveh Zahedi. And people may know some of his work in the past on a film that I actually helped make called I Am a Sex Addict. I don't know if that's came to anyone's consciousness over the years. It came out about 10 years ago.
Matt's a huge fan of that movie. He won't stop talking about it. It's a little weird.
Oh, great.
Yeah. It's kind of incessant,
Yeah, it is
actually.
A weird movie to not stop talking about, but still, it's a good film. He made one of my favorite movies of all time in the early 90s called A Little Stiff, which is like a black and white sort of 16mm film recreating his crush on an art film student. And the I Am a Sex Addict is sort of a faux documentary or hybrid documentary about his actual struggles with sex addiction. So he works in this kind of self-referential, self-reflexive kind of Brechtian filmmaking mode where he's sort of showing you the limits of narrative expression and being very sort of self-critical and self-examining. Some would say solipsistic and narcissistic, but he would ask, "You mean narcissistic?"
That's what Kelly would
in a bad
say.
Way?
Oh, mean narcissistic in a bad way. That's interesting.
That's actually a moment from the film. Someone at a Q&A asked him like a question, and you just see his response. He goes, "Do you mean narcissistic in a bad way?" But if that appeals to you, that idea, he's just done a show for Brick and it's called The Show About the Show. And the first three episodes are online already, and they basically continue his filmmaking pursuits in a smaller form. And it's basically what it is. It's about him trying to pitch this show to the Brick TV people, and he's cast it with some of the real people, and some people are played by actors, and all of the actors are basically taken from the sort of current Brooklyn independent film scene. A lot of notable names, if you're following that kind of thing, guys like Dustin DeFay and I'm trying to think of some of the other ones that people may know. If you've seen any of these kinds of films, you'll recognize a lot of the names. It basically is a sort of warts and all look at his life and the struggles that he has with not only himself and his wife and his children, but with trying to get this film made.
So
I highly recommend it. They're like 15-minute episodes.
We got to get off in a second. So just really quickly recap those four. And basically, the Deadwood feature film is sort of like the only one for people outside of New York.
No, the Brick TV one is online, so you can watch that anywhere you are.
Okay,
I'll
great.
I'll send you the link to that. So
okay.
You can link to that.
Okay, great. And then the other two are the just say that one more time for people in New York.
That's okay. I can go right now. It's fine. If you gotta go, you gotta go.
No, no. Say it. Say it.
No, that's all right. I've never
heard. No, there's other forces at work here. It's not me, buddy.
That's all right. I understand.
Yeah, I've never
the
seen
show about the show. That's the one I want people to come away with. Brickartsmedia.org. You can find it. The show about the show. It's got Alex Karpovsky from Girls, Eleanor Hendricks, guys like that.
Awesome. Film guy Matthew, I do want to go to that those screenings with you on Friday.
Okay, well,
thank you so
we'll
much.
Talk offline.
All right, talk to you soon. Be well.
All right, buddy, take care.
Bye bye.
Bye bye.
Okay, everybody. Sam has returned from his civic duty. We're going to go into the fun half or not fun half. You tell me, Sam.
Just give me 5 minutes. I'll
okay.
Flint story.
Okay. So Sam is literally going to come right now, put on some music, and that's it.
Folks, yeah, I wanted to hop on to the show. I just got back. Literally, the state Supreme Court is 10 minutes from here, not even by foot. And on day three of the jury selection, they decided to reject me. I'm not going to say much about the case, but it was a personal injury case. And they did not question me until I was the last person questioned of 20 people. Well, I can tell you the plaintiff attorney wanted me on there. But, you know, they ask you, like, do you have any relations with any attorneys? Not not physical relations, although I guess that would be included. But I said, you know, I do a radio show. I was not referring to this one. I mean, I told them I do a daily show. I mean, if there were more people, unfortunately, they had released, they're looking for six and then two alternates, and they start with 20. And at the beginning, I'm thinking, there's 20 people here. I can get two new listeners. And I knew who they were. I knew who their guys were. One was a DA. Another guy was, I mean, I knew who they were. I could see what they were reading on their phones. Like, you know, one was reading like Jezebel. And I'm thinking, this guy is going to be a listener. And I'm going to, so I got to get up there and be questioned in front of everybody to turn some people onto the show. And I'm literally the last person they question, and they've already dismissed almost everyone. And I didn't even get a chance to go into it at that point because they had forgotten by day three, they had forgotten who they had interviewed about what in their specifics. And so I had to tell the defense attorney, you know, they were asking like, do you know any lawyers? Do you blah, blah, blah. And I said, well, yes, I was raised by lawyers, almost like in the wild. I went to law school for a year. No problem with that. And I said, literally, I left here yesterday to go interview the head of, I did this interview for Ring of Fire, like at 5 p.m. The head of a plaintiff attorney lobbying organization. And I said, I mean, they want you to be very frank. And, well, no, they, you know, I had watched 19 other people get interviewed. And so I saw the parameters of what type of things they wanted to hear. And I said, I have to be honest with you. There are some things that, like, I don't believe that in any way I would be biased in terms of the facts of the case. But I took issue with some things that you were saying yesterday. And she's like, okay, let's go outside. Because they don't want to taint the rest of the jury pool. And I said, you know, it has no bearing on the case, as far as I know. I mean, that's the thing, is I don't know anything about the case. And I said, but you said yesterday that everybody gets an opportunity. If they want to sue, they can sue. Anybody can sue. You don't need to have a lawyer. You don't need to have this or that. And I said, you know, I take issue with that because there's a lot of practical obstacles that have been put up as barriers to get into the courthouse. Not the least of which is I'm perfectly aware of the fact that there has to be an attorney who says, yeah, I'll take your case for 30% of it, particularly in a situation like this. So I didn't think that that was, and she's like, okay, we'll put that aside. And
by the way, what do you think of the mustache?
And I said, you know, this is just to freak out my kids. And it was fascinating because I said, look, I have no reason to believe at all that I would be anything other than a fair arbiter of the facts. Meanwhile, you can't talk to the defense attorney without the plaintiff attorney being present and vice versa. The plaintiff attorney is like drooling. He's like, you seem great to me.
This guy seems really intellectually honest.
No, I think this guy is perfect. And I said, and she said, well, do you have any biases that you think could impact this? And I said, look, I don't know what the trial is about. I have listened to a lot of plaintiff attorneys on a lot of cases, ranging everything from construction building to, you know, DuPont. And I've talked to some, I've talked to many on air, I've talked to some off air about what they find in discovery and in depositions, stuff that never necessarily even comes out because there's a settlement. And I said, I got to be honest with you that in terms of assessing the veracity of what a corporate spokesperson would say, my threshold is probably different than your average person off the street. And I said, I can't really say anything other than that.
And the plaintiff attorney is just like, yes, yes, I'll agree.
Honestly, yeah. The plaintiff attorney is going, well, yeah, but you're not saying that you'd be unbiased.
I think you'd be totally fair.
He's honestly, and I like the defense attorney is just, she's just like looking at the plaintiff attorney like, you got to be kidding me. You don't think that, like, I'm going to seat this guy, do you? And, you know, I couldn't, I was like, if this was like any other type of trial, I would tell you that, you know, I have no doubt, but I have to be honest. And I was frankly a little bit bummed. I mean, you know, they don't call you back for another 5 or 6 years. You don't even go back into the eligibility for 5 or 6 years. Now, I guess I could say, like, I could drop them a line and say, like, available. because I found just even the questioning to be really fascinating. Just the way that they were both trying to set up the jury pool to be sort of like open to what they were going to present.
I think if you sent them just a clip of what you've said so far, you would be out of the jury pool for the rest of your life.
No, just in this type of case. I mean, I wanted to be totally honest and fair to the defense attorney because,
because you're biased and think that they...
I'm biased.
Well,
I'm just saying
that...
Well, you
have heard people say that they hide as much as they can and it doesn't come up in discussion.
I feel that I am potentially I come with some predisposition in terms of assessing the veracity of certain things that are introduced into evidence that are completely generic. And they wanted me to be more specific. It was interesting because I thought, you know, I thought that's my responsibility. I just lay it out there. They decide. But they both were clearly advocating for me to say something that apparently they had agreed upon, which would be the litmus test. And it was like, it was like, I felt like I was with my two divorced parents. And they were basically saying, like, whose house do you want to live in? And I was saying, like, I don't want to live in either one of your houses, frankly. I'll just stay where I am. You guys sort out who's going to live there.
And the plaintiff attorney was like, oh, I get what you said.
No, I get
good.
You're totally
hear
absolutely
you loud
right.
and clear.
No, you're absolutely right. And I could, the defense attorney, like, at one point, she was just like, and she also had this same mustache, which
wow.
worked in that manner. She did not.
And she was like, not. I'm sorry you feel that way. Sorry you don't love your mother.
So that was that. So in one respect, sadly, in another respect, well, it's I'll be back. Because I would this case would have been 2 weeks, I would say. Week and a half. And
sounds like you would have been fascinated by it.
Ah, my God. I was enjoying just sort of like watching the way that these guys, because that's all they do. Like, they're just really trying to lead people to an answer. And in, and I had, you know, this is the third, I think, time I've been to this, to part of the process. One time was in Manhattan, years ago, and I didn't get picked for a jury. One time was in Hudson when I was living up there, and I actually sat on a DUI case.
How long did a DUI case take?
I think it was maybe a day or two. Maybe probably 2 days. And I found that interesting. You know, I was pretty psyched. I was pretty psyched for this. But the upside is they give you just for showing up, because I was there for 3 days, which is a long time. And the difference is in the two cases that I were was considered as a juror, they were criminal cases. And so all of the questioning happens in front of a judge. In this instance, it doesn't. So you're just in a room with the two attorneys. And every 5 minutes, they're like, can I talk to you outside? Because they're this is both these attorneys are trying to sort of like push the limits of what they're able to do at this stage in the case. And there's no arbiter there to sort of corral them or to get mad at them. And so they know it's like, you know, mommy or daddy's not here. I'm just going to get away with what I can get away with until sis or brother says, like, can we speak outside? And so it was the whole process I found to be fascinating.
Is there any alternative to selecting juries for ignorance? Like you have any kind of idea of the topic, then you're automatically like not likely to be.
Well, they gave us the broad strokes. They it involved I guess if I'm not serving as a juror, I can talk about it. I don't know the specifics, but it was about somebody who I think got hurt on a bus or by a bus, so there was questions like, do you know any bus drivers? Do you know any medical professionals? Have you ever had a back injury? And then there was, and do you know any lawyers? And so that was the only one that.
A little bit.
Yeah.
A little bit.
I was like, I don't know if I know anybody who's not a lawyer.
Right, like even if they're not, even if you're like you're in this office, even if you're not a trained lawyer, Jesus Christ, you're a lawyer on some level. You just that personality type is drawn to you.
Yes.
Yeah.
There's a lot of advocacy here. But like I say, at the end of the process, because I was there for 3 days, they give you a, where is it? It's sitting over there on that box. Bring it over. We'll show it on camera. It is a vinyl binder with a free notepad. Yes. It's, I'm, you know, like, I was like, I'm going to use this. And then I was like, wait, no, because eventually it'll wear out. Look at that. It's got the state seal.
It's like a graduation present.
It really is. Like the guy was like, and this is for you. And I'm like, are you serious? Wow. This is fantastic. I don't know if I'm going to get paid. Do $40 a day, which is a, I don't think I'm eligible because I'm self-employed, but the, it's also, you know, for some people, it's an extreme hardship. $40 a day. There was a woman, a young woman who was a single mother. $40 a day. I mean, she's losing half of her pay or three quarters of her pay, or I can't do the math, but it wasn't good. All right, we're going to take a quick break. I'll get to this story about Flint. I mean, you haven't touched on the Flint or the Keystone story, have you?
No.
Definitely. On Monday, I imagine on Tuesday, what we're going to do is have someone on to talk about the oral arguments in this Friedrich case. That is going to the Supreme Court. It's going to be really huge implications for unions, as and we see this as a rolling theme. Also, this week, if you've run out of majority reports to listen to, you should check out the Ring of Fire podcast that is available through iTunes. We're revamping this stuff quite a bit. But we had a couple interviews, one with Harold Pollack, some interviews that, you know, I tend to think are too short for this program or not, but Harold Pollack, who we had on a couple of months ago, I guess. Yeah, I should catch people up on a couple of these things. Harold Pollack, we had on a couple months ago. He has a financial advice book that he wrote with Helene Olin, who we also had on this program maybe a couple of years ago when her last book came out, which is very straightforward financial advice, very uncomplicated. So that's interesting. Definitely worth a listen. Also, check out that book. Also, major story in the New York Times about the DuPont C8 case. And in fact, they did a story on the attorney who was sort of like the Aaron Brockovich figure in this, I guess maybe this was in the New York Times Magazine. Yeah, Rob Bellette. And Rob was actually going to be sitting down with us in Vegas. And I hope to get him next time I'm there. The person who sat down with us ended up being Chris Paulos, who is from 11 Papantonio. Because what happened is Rob Bellette basically marshaled this case over the course of 10, 15 years, 16 years. And there were different cases in different stages of it. And it culminated in a trial that took place in, I think it was October, late September, which was the first of these big cases of 3,500 or so cases. And it was Papantonio, Mike Papantonio, who actually tried that. And so I met Rob when I was in Vegas, who was going to sit down with us, but he had to leave. And so we had Chris Paulos, who, you know, was intimately involved in that whole story. So you can check out that podcast. I believe it was from October, the first week of October. Maybe it was October 8th.
Also made the best ofs.
Oh, it made the best ofs. Okay, so you can also listen to the best ofs. And if you want to know more about the C8-2, we had Sharon Lerner on the program, who had written a piece for The Intercept, and that, I believe, was sometime over the summer. Maybe it was, I feel like it was over August break. So check those out if you want to get more of that story. You're going to hear a lot more about
August 13th.
August 13th. So we're going to take a quick break, head into the fun half of the program, ladies and gentlemen. JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. You should buy your coffee there. If you buy crap from Amazon, buy it through our link at MajorityReportKickback.com. I am hoping on Monday to announce a new partnership that we have. We're one of the first people to have an affiliate link with them. One of the first.
This is really exciting.
We're not going to do away with the Amazon one. Some people are still married to Amazon, and but there's a company out there that is sort of a competitor to Amazon now. I mean, obviously not nearly the size, but does many of the same things, called Jet.com. And I believe on Monday we're going to have a link so that we're basically going to have the same deal. So for people who don't want to use Amazon, or for people who have already made the move to Jet, you can buy through our link, and hopefully I'll be able to have set it up by Monday, and it will be live. So, I don't know. That's exciting to me.
It's awesome. Be able to have the same service in Amazon without all the problems. That's great.
That's right. All right, folks, we will see you on Monday. If you're a free beer, if you're a member, please join us. Please join us in the fun half. Have you played any of these sounds?
Just the Jeb Bush one.
You did the Statesman of the Year one already?
I did. Matt was so excited because Matt wrote this great material for it. That we need to get out of the system.
I don't know if people watched the town hall last night, which I thought was an effing joke in many respects. It was literally like almost like a Disneyland ride where they just kept having all these like right wing nut jobs pop up. Like it's a small psychotic. Demented world after
Mr.
all.
Mr. President, I know you hate America, but I guess my question is in two parts, why? And the second question is are you going to be taking all of our guns and making us infertile within the next 6 months, or is that a longer time horizon?
Let's talk about that.
Thank you, Anderson.
We'll talk about that in the fun half, be that as it may. All right, we'll be right back after this.